No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one would have dreamed that we were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even consider the possibility of life on other planets, and yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely they drew their plans against us.
G'day, I'm Rob.
And I'm Dave.
And yes, the Doctor Who Show is pleased to welcome back our own international jet-setting man of mystery, Dave. Dave, welcome back. And briefly, where have your travels taken you?
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be back. Basically, North America. So I went through New England and then up to Montreal and back down. So Boston, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, the Hamptons. I spent a bit of time there just having a bit of a rest. So yeah, very nice trip.
Lovely. Have you had your fill of lobster by now?
Yes, I knew that I was in Maine where lobster was being served with a scrambled egg for breakfast.
That sounds like heaven to me.
It was pretty nice, but no, it's good. I'm home for an entire 6 days before I fly to Canberra for a week on Sunday, so I'll enjoy the next few days in Melbourne.
Crikey. Well, look, obviously you've been away for the last couple of weeks, and you've sent us emails and such, but I'm sure you've got something to say about these episodes as well to our listeners before we get on to this week's.
Yeah, look, thanks. So I was actually able to catch both of these episodes on BBC America, which was kind of cool. But no, it's been really interesting, Rob. I want to get your view as well, because in the last week or so, I've noticed in my particular fan circles, in terms of friends, people I follow on social media, podcasts I listen to, there's been a really interesting, I think really, you know, well-had discussion about the whole Mug trilogy and whether it worked or not. I think it's fair to say there's been a bit of a consensus around this idea that most people, an overwhelming majority, in fact, I think, did enjoy the episodes watching them, but the further they've got away from them, the more they've sort of watched these plots fall apart before their eyes. And it sort of depends on how forgiving you are of some of these plot issues as to how much you then sort of retain your enjoyment of the episode. How does that feel to you?
Yeah, I would concur. That's what I'm seeing in my circles as well. Generally, I think people thought Veritas was the best of the three, and then the more they thought about the next two, the more they fell down for them, as you're saying. Generally, they've looked back and thought, gosh, did we really need that trilogy? We were just enjoying episode of the week type stuff before that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because as a trilogy, they've tried this idea, and I think it was very well worth trying, of having three different writers write the three different segments of a trilogy. But I get the feeling that there was just a little bit of a lack of overarching coordination there, because the powers or the abilities of the monks seem to change with each episode. And more importantly, I don't think we had any motivation from the monks by the end.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one podcast I was listening to said that, and they sort of said, well, they're sort of a parasitic race, but that's what we're sort of inferring. We're not being told that. We're not learning that through the story, really. We're just sort of guessing that they're parasitic and they need to be loved. Yeah, it was just a bit weird. And they did, I put it that they seem to get dumber each episode, to the point where in that final one, they're looking at Bill. She's incredibly treasonous in her mind. She's there to, you know, get to the Doctor, and, you know, she wants to bring him down because she can remember that they haven't been in charge of the Earth for thousands of years. And yet they can't figure that out. How? Why? I don't know.
Yeah, and that's the same. And also the inverse of that in terms of the Doctor, and I mentioned this in my email, you go to the trouble of having the Doctor email himself advanced warning that the monks are coming, but there's actually, I didn't think, any payoff for that in the follow-up episode.
No. You can tell there wasn't a writer's room behind these three stories.
Yeah, look, I must admit, as much as I did enjoy watching that third episode last week, when the final credits rolled, I don't know if you've seen the Kevin Smith movie Dogma, Rob.
Yes.
But do you know the scene at the end where Alanis Morissette as God has just sort of sold everything, and Jane Yu stands up and starts very irately asking a lot of very obvious questions?
Mm-hmm, yes.
That was kind of what I was doing at the end of that. Who the hell were these monks? What did the monks want? Why were they here? Why did they go away so easily? What's going on? What's this all about?
Yes.
And to make a serious point, I've speculated, and others have knocked this theory down with some, you know, reasonable deduction, and that's fine, but I've speculated that there must be more to the monk's story than these three episodes.
I've seen people say that too, and some people have tied it into the whole the monks are the Cybermen thing, Cybermen without their gear on, I guess. I still find that a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I'm not necessarily saying that the monks come back with a sort of a denouement at the end of the season. We sort of find out all what was it all about, but maybe it's going to be like The Long Game and Bad Wolf, where at the end of the season we then find out, oh, actually all of this was a setup for that. Or maybe it's like the Vardens and Zontarans in Invasion of Time. You know, it turns out the monks were just a set of shock troops for something else, or, you know, it was a plot or a distraction, or there's going to be some explanation there, because otherwise I think it's very unsatisfying, which is a really great shame, because as I said, I enjoyed all three episodes whilst watching them. They just fall apart so quickly afterwards.
Yeah, I hate to tell you, I think it's just going to be unsatisfying. I think they've been swept under the carpet and we've moved on.
Yeah, look, maybe, but I guess, you know, I want to have it on the record that if they do come back, or if there is a payment, I, you know, at least I can say I told you so.
Fair enough, fair enough. Now, Empress of Mars, shall we kick off with our word of the week?
Sure, so what's yours, Rob?
My word of the week is valediction.
Okay, mine is nostalgia.
Uh-huh, I think I know where you're going. You may know where I'm going.
I think so, and I do point out, listeners, we're recording this literally about 3 hours after I've stepped off a 20-hour flight, so don't expect any really cryptic stuff in this recording from me.
And we also haven't conferred either. I've been very careful, even on Twitter, not to reply to people about the episode, not to comment on it, so that you would get no sort of sense of what I'm thinking.
Yeah, and look, I wish I'd done the same, because I must admit I did, sitting at the airport waiting for my flight, just after I'd watched this episode on iView, and I thought it's safe to go back onto Twitter now, because all my Doctor Who friends have stopped tweeting about English Trump, and, you know, we can all move on. Unfortunately, they all tweeted massive spoilers for this episode.
Oh, no.
It teaches me for going on the internet between watching and the broadcast, but that's fine.
Fair enough. I'd like to kick off by talking about the Doctor, in broad brushstrokes at least.
Yeah, okay, go on.
The Doctor in this episode didn't seem as impressive to me as past stories this series. He was good, don't get me wrong, but I didn't come away from it thinking, oh my God, I've just watched a Capaldi masterclass in acting. He seemed a bit tired, a bit flat almost. Maybe he didn't have enough material. I don't know.
I don't disagree with you. I'm probably a little bit softer on that judgment. But as I look through my notes, there were a number of question marks I did have around the Doctor. And with one other part of the plot set aside, that was the only really big set of question marks I had over this episode. And if we can jump to the end, mm-hmm. I wrote myself a note here while I was watching, and I'll read it to you verbatim, Rob. It says, WTF was the thinking like a warrior line about?
Yeah, because because he had to make himself a warrior when he drank that magical potion, Paul McGann I'm talking about, to become a warrior, because normally he wouldn't be thinking like a warrior. I thought that was the whole point of that becoming the War Doctor moment. Are we saying he always thinks like a warrior now?
Yeah, I found that a really bizarre line that, to me, really grated and went against the grain of what I've understood to be the character of the Doctor for 50-something years, that he's not a warrior. He's the antithesis of that.
Indeed.
Yeah, so I found that a really odd line that I mentioned, because it did come at the end of a number of lines that, as you say, were either flat or slightly odd.
Mm. Now, I'm glad you raised that, because that wasn't in my notes, but again, I specifically thought of the McGann moment of having to deliberately become a warrior, because that's not what he is. So, yes, yeah, totally, totally with you on that one. Yeah, I just found the Doctor a bit off in this one. I liked his negotiations with the Ice Warriors. I liked the way he was, you know, talking to them, using their customs, doing the hand on the chest thing and all that sort of stuff. That was all great. But there was just something, like I say, I didn't come away from it thinking, oh my God, Capaldi masterclass. How wonderful.
No, neither did I, but I did enjoy, I enjoyed the actor more than I did the character in this one. And that indeed goes right back to the cold open. Look, it was quite a fun cold open in some ways, but did you feel there was just a little bit of sort of David Tennant's smugness creeping into that scene?
Yes, and this comes back to something I raised last week, and I know you've raised in an email as well, and that's the arrogance of the Doctor coming through this series a bit more.
Yeah, and these last few episodes particularly as well. He didn't seem to do this in the first half, and we really enjoyed that. But, you know, I particularly raised it with the middle episode of the trilogy where he's busy being completely outplayed by the monks whilst making, frankly, really wanky speeches about, oh, look at how good I am. And to have him sort of here do that whole smug little Tennant-esque bit at the start with Mission Control, again, detracted from what was a really fun scene. Like, I love the scene. I love the way that it set up a real mystery as to what's going on. I was kind of hoping one of them was going to say the chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one.
Nice throwback to the pre-credits sequence of this episode, Dave.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of War in the World references we can probably drop in this episode. But, yeah, like, a really fun teaser, a really fun episode. And just every so often, I'm just looking at the Doctor going, no, that's not very Doctorish.
Yeah.
That's a little bit smug. Are we going back to that? And I hope we're not, because he wasn't for the first half of the season. I think everyone loved it.
Yeah, well, it's definitely there. And it's a shame, because I just like the fluffy Doctor from the pilot.
Yeah. So let's pull back to 30,000 feet here, Rob. Mm. What did you think of the episode?
In general, I felt relieved that we were back to an Adventure of the Week episode. After those three connected stories, I was starting to get a little bit itchy. Like, I just want to have a weekly episode where they just have a great time. And it obviously felt quite retro, which was something Paul Scoones was anticipating on last week's episode as well. And that certainly came true. It was very retro. Retro to the point where it was quite straightforward. It just, I've seen some people unkindly say it just plodded along towards its resolution, but I can see where they're coming from. It was just a very straightforward story, very retro in nature. And that's why I think some people out there have liked it, from what I've seen, you know, reading comments since out there on the web. But it could be why some people aren't so happy with it as well. They might want something a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you say that, because as I look back at how I felt watching this episode, and let me go back, right back to the start, I actually walked into this episode really quite worried, because I know you guys watched the trailer and thought this is going to be really cool. I watched the trailer and was worried it was going to be really, really silly, particularly given that it's also a Mark Gatiss episode, which means it's either going to be fantastic or terrible, and fandom will probably divide on, you know, which view they have. I think everybody's got Mark Gatiss episodes they love. Everybody's got Mark Gatiss episodes they hate, and they're all different episodes.
Yes.
He's that sort of writer. But as I said, as it opened up, I've gone, this is really interesting. I thought the way they set it all up in terms of why there were Victorian-era British soldiers on Mars was really clever. So that got me past, I guess, my initial worry. At the halfway point, I was thinking, this is really obvious. This is plot by numbers, and I can see where everything's going with such ease that it's actually going to be quite dull. But by the end of it, the way that that plot had been delivered and executed was such fun and so well done. I've gone, yeah, I really enjoyed this journey.
Yeah, I can see that. And indeed, there's very few things I'll actually pick on through the course of this podcast. There's little things I'll say here and there. You know, the Empress at one point was sort of channeling the Wicked Witch of the West. And that was the moment from the trailer that made me very scared about this episode. But thankfully, she wasn't like that for the whole episode. It got a tad self-indulgent with her cries of, sleep no more, sleep no more. And I was wondering whether that was a bit of an FU from Gatiss to the audience in general. Because if people cast their minds back to Sleep No More, you know, he was really into it. He thought this was really clever. It was the greatest thing he'd ever written. And Moffat was like, this is fantastic, and we're going to have a sequel to this. And, you know, well, that sequel's never come about. And I think the reason why is when they finally sat down, they realized that fandom thought Sleep No More was cack. So I just wonder if he put in that sleep no more line. It's just a reference to that previous story. And that took me out of the episode a little. It was maybe a little self-indulgent. Maybe there's something more to it. I can't believe that it wasn't deliberate in some way. But these are just small things I picked up here and there.
Yeah, look, it would have to be. I must admit, I missed that reference. So went completely over my head. But that said, I was watching on iView at New York Airport. So
yeah, fair enough. There's a lot more interesting things to see at New York Airport walking past.
Yeah, look, that's true. The Ice Warriors themselves.
I thought they looked good. They're big, they're menacing. There was no reason for them to get out of their armor this time, which was my huge beef with Cold War when that funny little creature got up and was scuttling about the ceilings and stuff and reaching down with those weird hands. They didn't do any of this time. That was great. I wish they'd never done that, actually, in that previous episode.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Their weapon, which crumpled up the corpses. Gosh, that was really scary and neat. And could I get one of those to fold clothes out of my dryer is something I was thinking. So I was really happy with how they looked. And their tombs, they looked fantastic. Reminiscent of cyber tombs with the way they were lined up, obviously, but very organic, completely different to cyber technology, but still looking similar. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I agree. I thought the Ice Warriors were really well done here. I must say, I do miss the clamps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do miss the clamps. I get that they're not practical, but it's part of the Ice Warriors, man.
Fair enough.
But yeah, look, I thought they were done in a really loving way. They looked good, as you said. They stood over everyone. They had that menace about them, but there was still that individuality about them, and they were effective. You know, there was no sort of sense of these are monsters that can be, you know, that are dim-witted or are stupid or ineffectual, like some monsters have been in New Who. They were really well done. I love the sound effect, you know, that throwback to the sound effect from Seeds of Death,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Particularly. You know, that was really good. And I did enjoy the line when the Doctor first saw the Ice Warrior and he said, this could go well or badly. And I thought it was both a nice reference to the fact he's met the Ice Warriors as friendly people and not friendly people, but also the fact that Ice Warrior stories themselves can be really good or really not very good.
Yes. Yeah. A very enjoyable episode, you know, across the board. As I say, my things I'm going to pick on are a few. Something I do want to raise, this has been a series that's tried to hammer home some real causes and beliefs, you know, like in Thin Ice, the capitalist guy was just horrible, and indeed in Oxygen, the suits were in charge, and, you know, it's been very heavy-handed with some of this stuff, and indeed in this episode there was quite a feminist moment where the Queen looks to Bill and wants her opinion, you know, because she's female, you know, let's talk over these shouting men moment. Okay, yes, Mark, we got that. That was a feminist moment. But it did have a fun moment where it tried to hammer home something, and it was the line about Victorian values, Dave. And you can almost see the cogs turning in Bill's mind as she says, because you're Victorians, which nailed both the humour and highlighted that these were indeed people with a different time and different values, something that Thin Ice, which I mentioned a moment ago, perhaps did less successfully. They were just painted almost as modern awful people in that story. It didn't really delve into why they might have been different or thought differently and so on. So I quite enjoyed that line.
Yeah, I did as well. I thought that was very well done. The Ice Queen's line, yeah, I'm kind of with you. It was a bit overstated. I thought it made perfect sense for the Ice Warriors to have a queen, and I don't think there's anything in prior stories that says that they're overly patriarchal. In fact, when Islia discovers that Joe, or he's told that Joe is a princess in Curse of Peladon, he takes that very much in his stride and says, okay, yep, she's a princess. She's therefore part of the aristocracy. There's no, you know, she's therefore lesser or anything like that because she's a woman. So I think it's actually quite established that the Ice Warriors are a equal opportunity monster.
Definitely, definitely. And of course, it did give rise to the title of the episode, which I've seen Gatiss describe as, who is the Empress of Mars? Is it the Ice Warrior Queen? Is it Queen Victoria, because her soldiers are up there claiming Mars for her? Is she the Empress of Mars? Or is it Bill? You know, Gatiss wanted to leave that kind of ambiguous. So I thought that was quite nice.
Yeah, and I think that went right through the whole episode where the end message, you know, God save the Queen, could equally have been Victoria or the Ice Warrior Empress.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, I'll save another point for later. Let's talk about Nardal.
I have very scarce notes on Nardal. Because I think this is one of the stories he probably wasn't meant to be in. And that whole TARDIS flying off on its own, A, it made no sense, and B, I think it was just there to take him out of the story again. It was almost like he hadn't been written into it. Then Moffat said, oh, you've got to have him in it, you know, Mark. And so he's just written him straight out of it in the opening scene.
Yeah, that was my explanation for it as well. I don't think it made much sense. What annoyed me here, though, more than that, was when we last spoke, Rob, we talked about how Nardole had a few very cool lines and moments, and you know, he's, you know, hey Nardole, you're just a badass, aren't you? And he's been a little bit straighter and a little bit more realistic. Suddenly here, he's back to making funny whimpering noises at the first sign of, you know, a red flashing light.
I was
really put off by that. It's not a big deal because he wasn't in the episode much, but to suddenly see him go from a character that has been developing and slowly growing on me as the series goes on to just a silly whimpering fool, I thought was a backward step.
Yeah, completely agree with that. I hadn't noted that down, but that's completely right. I didn't pay a lot of attention to him in the whole episode, you know, because they wrote him out so early and he wasn't really part of it. So the bits he was in, yes, I can see that now. It's, again, you can tell there's not a writer's room behind this, can you?
Yeah, and a number of friends and I have often over the years speculated about who is it in Modern Who that has that job that was traditionally the script editor, that Terrence Dix, Robert Holmes, Chris Bidmead, David Whittaker, Andrew Cartmell, Eric Saywood, you know, who really is responsible for that job on the new series?
There is someone. They're in the credits, but they're not as high profile as they used to be. It was obviously the producer and script editor working in tandem, and we still have producers, we still have script editors, but they're very much in the background now, and it's all about the showrunner. And Moffat gets up there saying, you know, I've rewritten this, I've rewritten that, and it sometimes makes me wonder, well, what does the script editor do? I should write into DWM and ask, you know, how do you divide up the work? You know, what happens?
Yeah, it'll be an interesting conversation to have, because again, when you look at the way that Nardole's developed over this season, when you look at the way the trilogy episodes that we just had panned out, they, to me, all seem to lack that real script editor-type role. And in the absence of a high-profile script editor, do we need to blame the showrunner for a lack of continuity in this season?
I think so. I mean, without wanting to turn things into a Moffat bash, because we're not about that at all.
Yeah,
I mean, if there is a script editor doing the grunt work, then the showrunner should be doing the finessing and the icing on the cake and remembering the smaller details, perhaps, and just filling in those gaps. And if they're not filled in, then yes, it probably does sit with him, I would think.
And you're right, I don't raise this to bash Moffat at all. It's a genuine query I have, because I think this season's showing a lot of strengths. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah.
But it does lack that overarching feel.
Agreed. And I don't know, maybe when he's doing more arc type stuff, his mind's maybe more on the job. I don't know. I can't make up excuses for him. But yeah, there are some inconsistencies, that's for sure, that we're seeing appear. Anything more on Nardole?
No, not really. As you say, he wasn't in it very much. And where he was really just a contrivance to get Missy out of the vault.
Yeah, I had a note here. Why have him in this at all? I mean, there wasn't a real need for it, really.
No. Again, maybe there's going to be an explanation down the line, but as you said, why the TARDIS suddenly dematerialized, you know, whether that was a setup, like Missy had done something to set that up so that she would be forced to be asked, I don't know.
Well, it certainly wasn't the Doctor. He was very surprised by it happening, so you can only conclude it's Missy, unless it's the TARDIS being sentient and taking him where he needs to be. It's always a bit iffy, that one, though.
Yeah, and there wasn't even that, you know, android invasion line of, oops, I left the key in, or oops, I forgot to, you know, put the handbrake on, or something.
We haven't really mentioned Bill yet specifically. I thought she was good, but like the Doctor, wasn't given a lot of really great stuff to work with. I mean, she was nice and she was funny, but it just didn't feel like Pearl got to deliver something she's proven herself capable of. Even in these past three episodes of the trilogy, I thought she got to do some wonderful stuff. But here, she was just there.
Yeah, and look, this is one of those episodes where, let's face it, if you took the Doctor and Bill out, it probably would have played out more or less the same anyway.
Yeah, because the guy who had been tempted to be hung would have been locked up, I guess. He would have been unveiled. He could have popped out and talked to the Empress and saved the day, so to speak.
The Empress would still have been found. She would have still revived her hive. There would still have been that conflict between the soldiers, and the Friday Ice Warrior would have probably still you know, being the peacemaker with the Colonel, and yeah, I actually suspect this is a bit of a revelation of the Dalek story, where take the Doctor and Bill out, and yeah, the story kind of continues as it is.
Yeah, and combined with what we've been saying about the Doctor and Bill not really having a lot of great stuff to do, yes, that comes across very strongly. Good observation.
So I did want to make a quick mention of this story in the context of Ice Warrior history.
Oh, please do.
So I thought this tied together the Ice Warrior history in a very effective way, in that it matched all the previous stories that we've seen before. The Ice Warrior Friday that we see here clearly left Mars at the same time as the ones that we meet in the Ice Warriors back in the first story, and that's why they've been in the glacier for so long, and that's fine. What I think is interesting is that clearly the Ice Warriors don't go from this story to being wonderful galactic good citizens, because they're incredibly nasty in the Seeds of Death, which is in the early 22nd century when they try to invade Earth. So there's clearly some up and downs in Ice Warrior society before they eventually come out the other side and evolve into the good guys that we see in The Curse of Peladon. And somewhere in the middle of that, you've got Mission to Magnus as well, if you want to count that as canon.
Of course, of course.
So, yeah, I thought this fitted in very well, but I don't think it's, you know, all one track for the Ice Warriors from here. There's obviously some highs and lows in their culture before that we get to Curse of Peladon.
Absolutely, and speaking of that, Gatiss, though, has tied this episode directly to the Peladon stories with the appearance of Alpha Centauri at the end, which I guess 95% of the audience will have no idea what's going on. No idea the person doing the voice is the original voice. I think that lady's now about 92 years old. No idea who this character is who looks like a giant phallus. Not that you can tell from the eyeball that's on screen.
They were very, very careful how they filmed that, weren't they?
They certainly were. So did you have any thoughts when that popped up? Were you just happy, or what did you think?
Unfortunately, this was the bit that had been spoiled for me, I think.
Oh, no.
Every Doctor Who fan in England, from, you know, Gareth Roberts down, tweeted out their just absolute shock, surprise, wonderment at that appearance. So I knew it was coming, which was a shame. But it was a really fun moment. I don't think you definitively would say that this is the same Alpha Centauri that we saw in Curse and Monster of Peladon, because that would be an incredible lifespan for that one creature. It could just be another delegate from Alpha Centauri. But yeah, look, obviously the Martians now go and find their adopted home planet, wherever that might be, and go on to become the members of the Federation that we see in 400 or 500 years' time. But as I say, they don't throw off their military shackles all that quickly. And whether there's, you know, a bit of pushback at some point, or I don't know, maybe that'll be explored in decades to come in Ice Warrior history. But yeah, the Seeds of Death does come next in terms of continuity, and they're the bad guys in that. And if I want to get really technical, in The Seeds of Death, the Doctor does say that the point of the foam is to turn the Earth's atmosphere into the atmosphere of Mars. So presumably Mars is still habitable for the Ice Warriors. Even if it's a bit desolate, the atmosphere is still habitable.
Yeah, no, that was my takeaway too. They could obviously exist there, but they wouldn't be doing much of anything else aside from existing. All right. As a departure story, because I think that's probably what this will be for Gatiss, does he go out a winner or a loser?
I think he goes out a winner.
Yep, I concur. I think he's done enough here to go out a winner. Because as you say, he's very up and down in his back catalogue. But here, yeah, I think he did it. I think he's gone out on a winner.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that a lot of the reaction's been quite positive. My reaction was positive. I think yours is too. And, yeah, there's a lot to like in this, so it's a nice – if this is to be his last one, and I suspect it won't be his last one ever. I think that, you know, we'll see more of this guy. It's certainly one of his better stories. It still doesn't beat Nightshade for me, which I think is the best work he's ever done, but, it's pretty good.
That's fair. Before we get to Word of the Week, were there any big points you wanted to make on the episode still in your notes?
No, I'm pretty happy with what we've covered, I think.
All right, Word of the Week. Who goes first, Dave?
Oh, look, I'll go first simply because I think mine was pretty obvious. I said nostalgia, and as we've discussed, this was a very nostalgia-filled episode. It felt like an older episode. It linked back to Pertwee episodes. It had the old monsters coming back. It it dealt with them in a really honest and true manner that wasn't, you know, revisionist or trying to take an ultra-modern take on an old foe and to the detriment. I think it was just good fun nostalgia.
Fair enough. My word was valediction, which I guess is the act of saying farewell, and this is where I differ to you. I think Gaddis is off. I think he is. And here he got to do the Ice Warriors again, the Ice Warriors on Mars, no less. He got to invent the Empress, further fleshing out their backstory after having fleshed out the fact that they can get out of their armor in Cold War, but the least said about that, the better. He gets to get his Victorian era on, then he ices the cake with Alpha Centauri, with the person who did the original voice, no less. So, you know, practically, I think this is it for him, but even if I didn't think that, all these elements to this very retro story almost feel very deliberate to me and almost like a valediction of sorts from Gaddis.
Yeah, look, I think this story really does feel like one where Stephen Moffat said to him, mate, this could be your last one, if not forever, certainly for a few years. Here's a blank piece of paper. You write the story you want to write.
Mm. Yeah, quite possibly, which is why it sort of sits out removed as most Gaddis stories do from the rest of the series.
That's a good observation, yeah, absolutely.
All right, so the moment of truth, our score out of 10. I'm feeling brave. I'll go first if you like.
Okay.
I'm going to give it a 7.5, and that's a very good, solid 7.5. It doesn't do enough to go any higher for me, but what it does well. It's quite enjoyable, and 7.5 seems to sit well for me.
Okay, I'm going to go a little bit better. I'm going to go 8.5.
Wow, you really like this.
I did. It's actually, I said a few weeks ago that this series, to my mind, has been lots of good, fun adventures that has lacked a true classic but also lacked a dud. And I think we're now, what are we, nine episodes into this now?
Yes, nine.
Nine episodes into this series, and I still think we haven't had a dud but haven't had a classic. Mm. But I did enjoy this one. It didn't have the depth or the rewatchability, I think, that a really true classic has to have, so I can't give it a 9 or 10. But I want to just say that it's my favourite so far, and so I'll give it that 8.5.
Fantastic. And with that, shall we go to the sports desk?
Off we go. So, Rob, good to be back at the sports desk, where, of course, every week we analyse the episode that's just been gone and we decide who was our play of the week, who was our MVP, and what was our fail of the week. So I haven't been here for a couple of weeks, so I might kick off.
Okay.
My MVP this week, I'm going to give it to Mark Gatiss.
Snap. Bingo.
There you go.
What else can we say?
Buzz. Look, I'll see if you need to add anything to my explanation here, Rob. Partly it's because I don't think anybody else individually stood up in this one and really won the day. Pearl Mackey was good. She wasn't at her best. Peter Capaldi was good. He wasn't at his best. The Doctor was a little bit off, as we've discussed. But we just spoke about how Mark Gatiss wrote a valedictory story and had a lot of fun doing it. So I think, yeah, he has earned it in a field that nobody else really was vying for it.
You could have been looking at my notes when you said that. There weren't many standout performances in this, in what was a good story. And so I was thinking further afield, and then I thought, yeah, you know what? He's had a very up-and-down career as a Who writer, but his heart's always been in the right spot. He's always trying to do something odd or interesting. I loved The Unquiet Dead and The Crimson Horror. I even thought Robot of Sherwood was pretty good, even though it got a bit silly when they shot the spaceship with the arrow. But let's put that aside. He's done some fun stuff, some good stuff. And he's a Who fan like us, so I couldn't go past him this time.
Yeah, look, I think that's a really good comment. I mean, let's go right back to his involvement with The New Adventures, which had some really solid books in there. You're right. Whatever else you say about Mark Gatiss, you cannot say that he hasn't had a go at doing something different and fun and original every time he's had a crack. Now, some writers play it safe and don't do that, and that means that they get a more regular good score. Mark Gatiss runs the risk of doing different things and therefore sometimes may having it work and sometimes it doesn't. A couple of the stories you mentioned I'm not a particular fan of, but I love, for example, The Idiot's Lantern. That's one of my favourite stories.
Hmm.
So, you know, I think every one of his stories somebody likes.
Oh, hell yes. There are people out there who like Sleep No More. you know.
Yeah.
I've seen that, and they're quite genuine in that. So, incredible. He's written... I mean, I jotted them down briefly. Unquiet Dead, Idiot's Land, and Victory of the Daleks, Night Terrors, Cold War, The Crimson Horror, Robot of Sherwood, Sleep No More, and Empress of Mars. So he's written a lot.
Yeah, that's quite a contribution when you think about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is, aside from, as you say, the books and so on that he's also done.
And stretched across the 10 series as well.
Yes, yeah, right back to Series 1 with Russell T, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, play of the week. I might take lead here. I'm going to say it was revealing the Ice Warrior tombs. And I mentioned this earlier. They're very akin to the Cyber tombs in some ways, yet still presented in their own more organic sort of way. I love seeing them light up in the sense that this setting was quite large, even though we know it was a studio story and maybe one of the cheapies of the series. It just added a bit of depth, and I just quite like seeing that moment. And again, it sort of took me back to the classic era. That's the kind of thing they do in the classic era of Doctor Who.
Yeah, I can see exactly what you're going with there. It's not a snap for me, but yeah, I totally agree with your thinking there. I went with the battle scene.
Oh, yes.
Because not only was this very well filmed, it was very well done, but the scene took an episode that could have just been a little bit too camp, maybe a little bit too fun, maybe a little bit too light, and just gave it that little bit of extra depth in there, because suddenly... the soldiers were being killed.
Mm. Yeah, horribly too.
Yeah, and I thought, as I said, halfway through this, I thought maybe, you know, there was going to be a big jokey end where everybody lives, everybody goes home, and they set up a holiday planet on Mars or something like that. You know, I could almost see it going down that path, but the battle was the moment where I've gone, wow, this isn't. This is going down a really appropriate path. It's adding real pathos to this. It's showing that it was really well filmed. I thought, this has made this story that could have been camp into a really good story.
No, it's a good scene, for sure. Foul of the week. Do you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, so I'm giving the foul of the week to the captain.
Ooh, okay.
Because I actually thought that he was a walking cliche, and we've said many times now that this was a Mark Gatiss script. This was, unfortunately, that Mark Gatiss comedy character that I thought, you know, he was the piss-take of the aristocratic officer.
Mm.
More than a realistic version of it. Every one of his lines I could see coming a mile off. I thought he was cliched, hackneyed. I thought that he was out of tone with the episode. So the one really weak point that I had in an otherwise fun episode goes to the captain.
Okay. My foul was, funnily enough, for a Gatiss script, I don't think this went far enough. Now, I know some will scoff and say, oh, Victorians on Mars, that's enough crazy right there. But that was just the setup, you know. What we eventually saw, and we've discussed this a bit earlier, so I'll be brief, was very A to B to C. And I guess that's why it seemed retro, which was nice. But I don't know. I just felt like the heat could have been turned up just a little more on this recipe without overcooking it and just giving it a little more oomph, maybe.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But I guess you could say that about a lot of this series, really, couldn't you?
Yeah, very true. Very true.
Fair enough. Well, shall we go to some listener emails?
I think so, because we've got quite a few this week, including some double-ups from people. So let's rip in.
Okay, well, I've got one from the gentleman who was very kindly and very efficiently keeping my slot going for the last couple of weeks. So thank you, Paul, and thank you for staying involved.
Thank you very much.
So Paul Schoons, who has emailed us in, hello@thedoctorwhoshow.net, and he's writing about this episode. Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on the last couple of weeks. Apologies for the slightly distorted sound at my end in the last podcast episode. Let's just say that it was caused by the monk's truth propaganda breaking through. Nice bit of retcon there, Paul.
And can I jump in for a moment and say something I didn't explain in the last episode? I said Paul is coming to us, you know, live from his collectibles store in his town in New Zealand. And I thought, I didn't explain why he's in this store. People are going to be sitting at home thinking, why the hell is he in his store? Because the store was closed. It was the middle of the night. It's because Paul's internet had gone off at home. So he went down to his shop and used the internet there. He sat at the counter, had people actually coming up and banging on the door in the middle of the night because he was in the shop sitting behind the counter recording the podcast with me. And, so briefly, that's partly why the sound was a bit down. I think water had got into the works in New Zealand and everyone's internet wasn't doing so well, but that's why he was actually in the shop. I'm pleased I got to explain why. Sorry to interrupt the letter, though, Paul.
That's okay. So Paul goes on, Empress of Mars is a love letter to classic Doctor Who. I had a feeling I was going to like it based on last week's trailer, and I wasn't disappointed. I'd rated a solid 9 out of 10 and one of the standout episodes of this series. A couple of things struck me about the episode. On the podcast last week, I talked about the reset button effect in the last episode. I think the opening scene this week makes it clear that the events of the monk's occupation have been wiped away. Despite the Doctor making video broadcasts for the monks for months, none of the people in the NASA control room seem to recognize him.
Good point.
Yeah, very good point. I think that's, yeah, unquestionably was a reset for better or worse, and I think for worse. Back to Paul. I was surprised that Bill was eager to risk removing her helmet on arrival on Mars. Has she learned nothing from her traumatic near-death experience with oxygen deprivation?
That's a great point, actually.
I thought that was a really good point, and it's one that I'm glad Paul's mentioned because I thought about it at the time as well. Just because there's oxygen present doesn't mean that there isn't an assortment of all sorts of other nasties present.
That's right.
It was just bizarre.
She was the keenest to be pulling her mask off first.
Yeah, and then for Nardole to come on and go, well, obviously, duh. Like, no, that's not. I thought it was really stupid. It was up there with, you know, a scientist working on deadly biological chemicals, taking his helmet off in the middle of an experiment going wrong in 2 weeks ago.
And just leaving it off.
Yeah, and then opening doors and venting poison. Let's not go back there.
Yeah, so don't listen to Nardole, kids. Wait until one of your friends takes theirs off, give it a few minutes, and if they don't drop dead, then you take yours off. That's how you do it, kids.
Yeah.
All right, I've got one here from Martin Notes. This is by email to us as well. He says, just a few words tonight on this, and here he's talking about Empress of Mars. He's also written to us about the last week's episode as well, which we'll get to in a moment. The pre-title sequence, I loved it. Visually, an excellent episode. But what was the point of it all? Took far too long to get the Ice Warriors properly involved, and the Queen sounded a lot like the Queen of the Ranknos. I think that was that big spider thing, wasn't it, Dave?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and I can't say whether she did or she didn't, because I must admit I've watched that episode once ever.
I think it's just that very generic, my pretties,
kind of.
Not that the Wicked Witch of the West actually says fly my pretties in The Wizard of Oz. That's, there's a word for that when people misremember.
Apocryphal.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, moving on, Martin says, on first viewing, disappointed. Cheers, guys, from Martin, also known as Beer is the Answer on Twitter. P.S. The regulars were all good, simply let down by the storyline. So there's someone who, I guess, Paul was more agreeing with you. Maybe Martin's more agreeing with me. I don't know.
Yeah, look, I could totally get somebody looking at this episode and feeling that, you know, there wasn't enough lead in the pencil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true.
I've got one here from David Clark, who also has emailed into us. Hi, guys. I just watched tonight's episode, The Empress of Mars, and got to say I really enjoyed it. I've been watching Doctor Who since John Pertwee, and this took me right back to being a seven-year-old watching with my dad again. Mark Gatiss did a great job on this one. Good to see the British Empire again. Joking aside, Pearl was back on top form again, and great to see a little blast from the past with Alpha Centauri. Great to feel like a seven-year-old again. Fab show, lads. Cheers, Dave.
Oh, that's really nice. That gives me a warm feeling to hear that someone felt that from the episode.
Yeah, and I don't think he'll be alone on that. I think a lot of that generation will feel that way. And I'll be interested to see some of the reaction from those people as the week progresses.
Yeah, I mean, it's Gatiss's own period of Doctor Who. Pertwee is his Doctor, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I've got one here from Mike Solko, who's obviously appeared on the show a few times. And Mike says, hi, guys. I haven't written in a few episodes, no doubt because I was still in season 27 hangover mode. That's a nice reference, Mike, to the episode we did on season 27. The three-part monk saga ended up being a disappointment by the time it wrapped up. Extremis was excellent, ratcheting up the tension and showing a virtual Doctor Who was every bit as brave as the real thing. The pyramid at the end of the world had some excellent production design, yet felt lacking in menace. The Lie of the Land was extremely frustrating, as it was nearly all plot-driven rather than taking time to show us characterization. Turn Left was a story that showed us the consequences of an alternate reality while still including a few big set pieces. We often see a lull when a two-parter doesn't land around the midpoint of a season. This felt like an even bigger disappointment since we have so few episodes remaining with PCAP and Bill. I hope that the next few episodes are an improvement. Thanks as always from Mike. And Mike, it'll be interesting to hear what you thought of this episode and whether you thought it did help with that.
Yeah, look, I think I agree with most of Mike's comments in there, particularly his problems with the pyramid at the city at the edge of the end of the world, which looked good, some good ideas in there, felt good, but yeah, we've discussed that.
Yeah. Moving on.
So the final one we have is another one here from Martin Oates, who has emailed us in again with a comment on last week's episode. Well, part three of the trilogy has been and gone, but what to make of it, both as a standalone episode and the grand finale? After two viewings, I'm simply not sure what to think. Did I like it? Of course, I always like a Doctor Who episode. Did I love it? Nope. Part one was great, parts two and three were good. There were some very good performances, namely from Bill and Missy, I must say, but I have to concur with the comment, back to the well. I had a sense of deja vu where I felt transported to the library or the White House. And I'm not a fan of the love saving the day quite so often either, plus the reset button, the big red button that should never be pressed, is a major bugbear of mine. Too often it is pressed, RTD and the Moff have both been equally guilty on both counts in the past. I am, however, looking forward to where Missy goes to next. Where she ties in with the John Sim Master and the Mars Ice Warriors story looks intriguing. Keep up the good, no, excellent work, guys. Martin Beery's the answer on Twitter.
Excellent, Martin. Excellent. And I think Martin's nailed it again with regard to that three-parter. I think everyone liked the first part. They just weren't so sure about the rest.
Yeah, and his comment about still not knowing what to think really sums up where I am. I don't know whether I judge it on did I enjoy it whilst watching it or the analysis that I did afterwards. You know, how are you meant to judge an episode like this?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we'll be sitting here in a year's time still wondering.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's a very good argument saying that if you sat down at 7:30 on a Sunday or a Saturday night and were entertained for 45 minutes, job done.
Yeah. Although in the age of box sets, do shows, you know, just go off and die like they used to in the olden days? You know, they're going to be rewatched and rewatched.
Yeah, and as you say, Rob, I think that's something we might have to make a note of and come back to when we get to the end of the season.
All right, let's wrap up with our Arc Watch and Fan Watch. For me, Arc Watch, we keep getting these small moments with Missy. I thought she would have been used a lot more by now, especially the middle part of that three-parter that we keep talking about where she didn't do a thing. I guess it's all coming to a head in the final two-parter. We're working up to something, how that all works. Is she going to be really good in the end? I assume not. But how does that tie into the Sim Master? Does he come back as the baddie that she has to battle? Or does she turn bad and the Sim Master turns up as a goodie? Because last time we saw him, remember, he was a goodie fighting Rassilon. Ugh, I don't know how that's going to work out, but that's my arc.
Yeah, look, I think what was interesting for me was that when the Doctor saw that Missy was at the controls of the TARDIS, there was a look, but there wasn't a sense of, oh my God, Nardole, what have you done? You know, get her tire up, get her back in the vault now. He was sort of like, okay, I'm not sure I approve, but neither am I particularly reacting.
It was interesting. You know, there could be a few reasons why he was like that. Maybe like when you see a prisoner who's escaped from jail, you don't want to startle them or like really yell at them or do something crazy because they're dangerous. So maybe he's playing it cool because she's dangerous. You know, there was a look like you've got your hands on my TARDIS. You know, there was a bit of a look like, not sure I like this. But yeah, he was playing it very cool.
And I also wonder whether there's a sense of the Doctor's really drinking the Missy Kool-Aid as well in terms of he's really buying into this idea that she is a good reformed person and, you know, deep down he desperately wants that to be the case.
Yeah, you can be blinded by that kind of thing sometimes. I mean, we hope that he's got something up his sleeve or in his back pocket in case she turns bad. But yeah, you can be blinded. So how will it play out? Could be quite interesting.
Yeah.
Moving on to Fan Watch, I think there'll be talk about Gatiss and whether this was it for him. I think it will be, again, to go over that territory. I mean, his mate Steve's off and I'm not suggesting for a minute that he only got some of these stories in because Moffat was there. Of course, he'd been writing before Moffat became the showrunner as well. But I just think there's a new guard coming in, a new wind is blowing through and every other cliche you can think of. And I just can't help but think that was it for Mark. And I think some people will talk about him this week and his legacy with the series.
Yeah, look, I think so as well. And I reckon the words Alpha and Centauri will get a particularly large reaction from fans over the next week.
Indeed. Now, next week, we have something we've been looking forward to for a long time, and this is Rona Munro from, obviously, the original series, wrote Survival, has written her next Doctor Who script, The Eaters of Light. And the blurb for it runs, "A long time ago, the 9th Legion of the Roman Army vanished into the mists of Scotland. Bill has a theory about what happened, and the Doctor has a time machine. But when they arrive in ancient Aberdeenshire, what they find is a far greater threat than any army. In a can on a hillside is a doorway leading to the end of the world." Dave, your thoughts on both these words here and obviously seeing the trailer?
I am always very wary about getting too excited by an episode, because that just sets you up for, you know, not meeting expectations. But Survival is my all-time favourite story from 1980s Doctor Who, obviously written by Rona Munro. I, like I think you, Rob, am a big fan of Roman army and the Roman history and yeah. all of that. I love Scotland both as a country and as a location. So this, to me, you know, this sounds like chocolate chip ice cream on chocolate cake next to a block of chocolate. You know, this has all the ingredients to be perfect, and I hope I'm not setting myself up to, you know, not meet expectations next week, but it sounds great. And the only thing that could make that trailer any better would have been the clip of Brian Blessed from My Claudius saying, "Where are my eagles?"
I'll agree with all of that, and it just makes me terrified now that it won't stand up to what I'm hoping it will be. The only query I have at this time is in that little blurb, Bill having a theory about the Ninth Legion. Has Bill come across as kind of a historian to you, or doing history at uni, or interested in history in any way?
No, that'll be interesting. But look, I think we've got 5 or 6 days to just quietly dampen down our expectations so we can go into this a little bit flat. But I think I'm more excited for this one than I have been for any episode this series so far.
All right, then I shall join you again Sunday. And we'll talk about it.
Looking forward to that one.
See you, mate.
See ya.
You've been listening to The Doctor Who Show, the podcast where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. Subscribe to us on iTunes or listen through the website at www.thedwshow.net. Write to us at hello@thedwshow.net or send us a quickie on Twitter @thedwshow. Facebook.com/TheDW Show is also a good place to find us if you're so inclined. Our version of the Doctor Who theme arranged by George Locke. Look him up on YouTube, folks. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. Doctor Who, all names and sounds, and any other related items are trademarks and or copyrights of the BBC. All other trademarks and trade names are properties of their respective owners. The official Doctor Who website can be found at www.bbc.co.uk/Doctor Who. Thanks for coming back to Australia, Dave. That's not really what I meant to say.
Yeah, the only reason I came back was to do the podcast, Rob. You know, nothing else is keeping me here.
All right, I know what I meant to say. All right.